stop wearing them. Humbled in the presence of the veterans, and not the ones who picked up their guns, but who picked up their brethren and sisterin. History in the making, I was witnessing, listening. Seen this old Japanese lady with a sticker on her walker, said, free Mumia. And this was before the Trustafarians were saying it, taking it for granted that we talk about the 60s and never get to talk to anybody who done lived the shit. Exists, or better yet, she still resists, speaking to a myriad of young, dumb, and ignorant kids. I was one of them, stuck around lingering, said that it's a privilege to meet you in person, and she took my hand, said it's good to meet you too, and when I'm out of school, ask me what I'm gonna do. I had to think about it, but...
We're about to talk a bit about Yuri Kochiyama with Dr. Diane Fujino, author of Heartbeat of a Struggle, The Revolutionary Life of Yuri Kochiyama, and Samurai Among Panthers, Ritsaioki on Race, Resistance, and a Paradoxical Life. She is professor of Asian American Studies and director of the Center for Black Studies Research at University of California, Santa Barbara. Welcome. Good to have you with us, Diane Fujino.
Thank you. It's great to be here, to be able to talk about Yuri Kochiyama.
This is an amazing history, and there was also, of course, there is such an amazing history people don't talk about very much in the relations between the African-American community and the Asian community all through our history, but especially in the 60s, that gets lost. But you're helping us not lose that, and I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. But talk about Yuri Kochiyama, this woman, and who she was, and because some of us know her, people know her when we say she's the woman in that iconic picture after Malcolm was assassinated and she held his head in her in her lap, looking down at him as he looked up at her as he was dying. And that's the picture that we all remember. But who was this woman?
She was somebody who actually changed very much from being rather provincial and apolitical. And it was inside the concentration camps that she started to, in listening to the older internees in the camps, starting to be able to understand the political context of that incarceration and starting to come to awareness of her own racial identity. But even after that, she continued her community service. But it was really the civil rights movement of the 50s that awakened, gradually awakened a consciousness in her. And in 1960, her family moved from Midtown New York to Midtown Manhattan to Harlem. And that's where she began in the early 60s to get involved in the movement around her, of course, with the really rich history of political and cultural resistance in Harlem. And she was doing things like fighting for better quality schools for her own children and the children in the Harlem schools. She was not afraid to learn about and stand by the most radical vision of a new and liberatory society, even though she herself didn't understand it. So in the early 60s, she supported the electoral campaign of Bill Epton, who was running as an open socialist, even though she didn't identify as a socialist at the time. But she saw the good work he was doing, and so she supported him. She wasn't afraid to support these kinds of radical politics because she saw the work that was being done. And so she came with this attitude when she met Malcolm X in late 1963. She didn't agree. She even told him she opposed his views on integration. She believed in them. And that took courage, you know, at that time to stand up to Malcolm and kind of his really bold, controversial persona that was put out there in the media, in the public media. But that openness that she had, Malcolm invited her to study with his Organization of Afro-American Unity Liberation School. And she began to learn more about the ideas of national liberation and structural racism and, you know, colonialism and imperialism. And these ideas resonated with her. And so she moved very quickly towards ideas of Black power and national liberation. And she was soon completely immersed in the struggles for Black liberation, for freedom for Puerto Rican political prisoners, and fighting for national liberation struggles. And when the Asian American movement emerged in the late 60s, she immediately became seen as a mentor for the young activists of the Asian American movement and helped to build the Asian American movement as well.
I think most people have never heard of her, right, in America. We don't know who she is. I mean, even people who
look... Absolutely. She is one of the most well-known and legendary Asian American activists. But in the U.S., people know almost no grassroots Asian American activists, or nothing about grassroots Asian American activism at all.
Exactly. I mean, I want to talk a bit about mm-hmm. that in a minute with you. I mean, but I think when people even looked at that photo in Life magazine when she was holding Malcolm after he mm-hmm. was shot, that people might not have even known she was Asian. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, mm-hmm. they might have thought she was a black yeah. woman holding Malcolm. And I think this is right. this is a revelation to a lot of people.
Right. You know, that's absolutely correct. That picture in Life magazine in February of 65 when Malcolm's laying prone, he'd been shot, and Yuri runs up the stage. She sees everyone else had ducked for cover. She sees someone run up on stage, and she runs up behind that person. You know, folks have said disregarding her own safety to try to offer comfort to him. And in that photo, there's no mention of her by name, which is understandable, but there's not even any notation that here's an Asian American woman at an allegedly, you know, black separatist event, right? So that should have raised questions about right. Malcolm's politics, right? And also about Asian Americans. But I noticed that after Yuri died, then Time Life reprinted that same photo, and they then, of course, identified her and linked it with her. But at that time, in 65, there was nothing. I mean, there was complete silence about Asian American connections to the Black Freedom Movement.
Take us back for just a moment. I come right back to Yuri because I want to finish talking about who she was and why she grabbed you so deeply and why we need to remember her as Americans and as mm-hmm. people who are trying to create a new world. But just take us back to the 60s for a moment, because we do not make this bridge. I mean, even organizations like the Young Lords of Brown Berets and maybe not so much the White Patriots in Uptown Chicago, but people don't realize the connection that happened, the revolutionary movement that exists among young Asian American people in this country, who they were and what they did during the 60s and 70s.
People think of the 60s and 70s as all these completely separate movements, right? And Yuri is a foremost border crosser. She's a foremost bridge builder, and that's one of her strengths. But she also came to those politics because they were all around her. And in the revolutionary movement, the groups were intersectional. They were working together in many, many ways. And so Yuri was a member of the Republic of New Africa, this group that might be seen as one of the most black nationalist movement, right, that saw black liberation through the establishment of a black, through land rights and through the establishment of a black nation in the U.S. South, right? A very controversial position. Mm-hmm. But they invited Yuri to be part of their organization. When Richard Aoki was invited to work with the Panthers and be one, people have told me that at the first meeting that they went to as a Panther, this was right after the formation of the Panthers, Richard Aoki was there talking about the concentration camp. So there was a lot more cross-pollinization than gets talked about.
So, and let me just digress for a moment as well. When you say concentration camp, talk about what you mean. This is the second time you use that term, and I think our listeners might not be sure what you're talking about.
Yeah, some say that that term should be reserved for Nazi Germany. I'm referring to the U.S., what I do call concentration camps, that incarcerated West Coast Japanese Americans during World War II. And people said, well, those weren't the same kinds of camps. And you know, I would say, well, what happened in Germany were holding camps and death camps. But the Japanese had barbed wire around them. They had a sentry to keep them in, not to keep people out. And so they were a prison camp. And so as the redress movement emerged and as the Asian American movement emerged, people's vocabulary began to change. So to now call it a concentration camp was fairly, you know, it's not uncommon today, the U.S. concentration camp.
So I think I wanted you to explain that because I think people don't get that when that's heard. They weren't sure what that meant, and I wanted them to get a clear understanding of your interpretation of that and what you meant. But I think that's important, what you laid out here. Mm-hmm. Let's talk for a minute, again, just from your perspective about the importance of Yuri Kochiyama. I mean, then what she says to us now in this 21st century, what she says to people who have never heard of her, especially young people in this 21st century, since we just lost her so close to her birthday at the age 93.
Mm-hmm. Yuri, she's deeply meaningful to many people. And I was just at an event just a couple of days before Yuri passed away, just last weekend, put on by the Asian Political, API Political Alliance, a student group here at UC Santa Barbara. And they were doing a night of cultural resistance, and they created T-shirts. And on that T-shirt, featured most prominently is Yuri Kochiyama. And people are hungry to find not just icons and heroes, but someone who can connect them to a political past, and I think a more radical vision of what's possible. And I think Yuri really represents kind of the possibilities for change, radical imagination, and freedom dreams about a better society, that we together can build a better society. She connected a lot of people, so it's not going to just be one group trying to get something at the expense of another group. She always looked at the most marginalized, the most oppressed groups, and always tried to think about their perspectives, and we need to uplift society from the bottom up. And she was a grassroots activist. She believed in community building. She believed in self-determination and taking control of communities. She believed in the importance of the land as a base to create new communities. And I think she then shows us a kind of model for organizing that is bottom-up, that involves participatory democracy and getting people involved in creating their own change, in having ordinary people see themselves as the leaders that we've been waiting for, right? To see ourselves as people who can create change, and connecting many, many people and communities together in building this change.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Dr. Diane Fugino, for joining us, for writing this book as well, Heartbeat of the Struggle, the Revolutionary Life of Yuri Kochiyama, and making us all think differently about where we are, who we are in this country. Thank you so much for the time with us today.
Thank you so much, Mark. I appreciate it.